Invite you guys to have a seat. Well, my name is Mike. It's great to be back with you guys. I'm thrilled to be able to enter back in the text with you. We have taken a week off last week, so if you missed last week and are worried that maybe you missed a chapter of Exodus, you're okay. Brad covered 3 and 4 2 weeks ago, and we're going to finish up now in chapter 5 this evening. Our goal will be to kind of work through that bulk of the text. We started now a number of weeks ago in this new series. And the idea of the Exodus, the theme that we have kind of elevated every week, is this idea of redemption, that this book is really a picture of something that happened now 3,500 years ago, but it's also very much a picture of what has happened in your and I's life. It's a picture of God redeeming his chosen, of God redeeming his people. And as we ventured in this book in chapter 1, we saw God's people, those that he loved, enslaved in a nation that was not theirs. The Israelites, the Hebrews, were in Egypt for 400 plus years, enslaved to the Egyptians. And in chapters 2 and following, we saw a guy by the name of Moses that God raises up. We saw him from a little bitty baby that's born in a very, very difficult time when male children were being put to death by the Egyptians. This boy is hid, and we see kind of the first 40 years go by of his life in a flash, where his mother Jochebed gives him into the Nile and has given him away, and Pharaoh's daughter raises this Hebrew son and has her own Egyptian child. And about 40 years in the journey of Moses in chapter 2, we see that Moses gets this grand idea, right? God's going to use me to deliver the people. He comes in, he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, and he says, now's the time that I'm going to enter in. I'm going to show everybody who I am. And he basically beats his chest and says, everybody come follow me. I'm the great deliverer. And everybody kind of around looks at him and says, you? Like, who are you? And in that moment, we see this utter failure of Moses, who missteps what God ultimately wants for him. He runs and hides at the end of chapter 2, and he flees to a place called Midian. He literally goes to the desert for 40 years, and he went from a somebody to a nobody overnight, the opposite of the overnight success, if you will. And he spent the next 40 years of his life literally in hiding. And Brad highlighted three things that God was about in Moses' life during that period. You remember those? There were three lessons that Moses desperately needed to learn: humility, obedience, independence. Those were the lessons that were taught by the wilderness, the things that God desired to teach in him. And at the end of this season, where God's really working on Moses, at the end of chapter 2, we hear this amazing little ditty in the last two verses of chapter 2 that says, God heard, God remembered, God saw, God took notice of his people. He heard the affliction of his people, and he remembered the covenant that he had made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God says, now, I'm going to move. I'm going to do something. And he called Moses, remember, at the burning bush, says, you're my guy. I'm going to use you now 40 years after you thought you were ready. Now that I've humbled you, now that you're willing to walk in obedience with me, now you're the guy that I need. And we see this humility in Moses come to the surface, and he says, oh, no, God, you got the wrong guy. I am not the guy that you're looking for. I was the guy 40 years ago, but not anymore. God says, you're going to go, you're going to speak to Pharaoh, and you're going to tell him to let my people go. And reluctantly, through chapters 3 and 4, we see Moses offer all these excuses that God says, man, I'm not having it. You're going to be the guy. And Moses reluctantly goes. In the last verse now of chapter 4, I want you to see what's happening as we kind of venture into chapter 5. God promised that he would use Moses to deliver these people. And he says, Moses, if you're so insecure, I will give you a sign. In fact, I'll give you three. He says, that staff that's in your hand, Moses, that shepherd's staff, it'll turn into a snake. And he shows them literally before his eyes. Take your hand, put it in your bosom, and you bring it out, and it's leprous as snow. And when you put it back in, it's miraculously healed. God demonstrates his power in Moses in these simple things. And it says in verse 31 that Moses took these things along with Aaron to the people, to the Israelites, and to the leaders, the elders of the people. And it says they believed, and they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, and they bowed down in worship. For the first time in 400 years, hope is in the air. There's this idea that maybe, for generations now that have just sat and said, this is our lot in life, that maybe something can change, that maybe God's going to enter into their lives and do something and deliver them just as he said. So that's how we enter into chapter 5. There's this hope, there's this lingering idea that God is on the move, Aslan's on the move, as Brad said the other week, that something is about to change and God's going to show up. Chapter 5, verse 1, let's watch now God show up. And afterward, it says in verse 1, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. Look at verse 3. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Otherwise, he will fall upon us with pestilence and with great sword, with the sword. Moses goes, and in fact, if you look at what God told him to say in Exodus chapter 3, verse 18, this is almost verbatim. He says exactly what God told him to say to Pharaoh. He's humble. He's obedient now. We're seeing a very, very different Moses. And he communicates now to Pharaoh, this is what God told me. This is what we're called to do. And in verse 2, we see Pharaoh's answer. But Pharaoh. That's never a good start, by the way. Whenever you see but, things are about to change. Who is this Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go. I don't know your God. I am the God of this land. I am Pharaoh. I dictate terms. I make the rules. I don't know your God. Furthermore, in verse 4, the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. What's going on here? It's like someone just pulled the e-brake in this chapter. I thought we were going to see God move and God deliver and God show up and begin to redeem his people, but it's like we're reading the wrong chapter. Something's happening. God isn't doing what they expected. In fact, it's going to get worse. Look at 5 through 8. And I want you to notice now what Pharaoh continues to do. It says in verse 5 that Pharaoh said, look at the people of the land, and they are many. And would you have them cease their labors? So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and said to the foremen, you are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks, which they were making previously, you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it because they are lazy. Therefore, they cry out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. He immediately, the same day, Pharaoh says, man, I'm taking a very different approach to this Hebrew people. The previous Pharaoh said, man, we're going to eradicate them. We're just going to kill them all. This Pharaoh says, no, absolutely not. They're useful. They're my slaves. I'm going to use them, and I would be nuts as a leader to let these people go. Then Pharaoh turns to the taskmasters, who are the Egyptians, and he says to them, you go tell the Israelite, the Hebrew foreman, that they're going to continue to do what they've always done, but I'm going to make their life miserable. I'm going to make it even more difficult. Before we, as the Egyptians, would provide them straw to make these mud bricks that they would then turn into walls or buildings or pyramids or what have you, no more. They can go get their own straw. And their quota is not going to change. What we demanded from them yesterday is the same that we're going to demand from them today. And the ultimate reason you see in verse 8, Pharaoh says, you are lazy. But this is not ultimately what we expected, not what we thought how this chapter would begin to unfold. Have you ever had one of those days where things didn't go quite as you planned, where you literally thought, man, I'd have been a whole lot better had I not even gotten out of bed this morning, right? When things literally go from bad to worse, I've had those days. I remember in my freshman year of high school, I took an honors biology class, which was a mistake in and of itself, taking an honors biology class. But I got in there with all my buddies, right, and we were goofing around in lecture, and they were teaching us about plant classifications. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Remember all that stuff that is useless now, but we had to remember it. And we were learning how to classify plants. I'm like, fascinating stuff, right? But we're learning this in lecture. And then in lab, they said, okay, you're going to get all these plants. We're going to put them before you, and then you're going to learn how to classify them yourselves. You're going to pick different ways to classify each different deal. And we're kind of looking around. My buddies and I are kind of the goofball class clowns, and we're watching all these other groups. They're all studious. And we thought, man, let's do something different. Let's classify them all by taste. So we start picking up, every flower or whatever they had in front of us and started putting it in our mouth. And as I look up and as I've got this white flower in my mouth, my teacher's eyes are like this. And she comes flying over, Shannon, Michael, what are you doing? You know, she starts yelling at me, takes the flower and throws it down, pulls me out into the hallway and just starts ripping me. I'm like, what is going on here? She's all upset. She's like, Mike, that's white oleander. It's poisonous. You can't put it in your mouth. And I'm like, what's white oleander? Like, I'm a Texan. I'm a city boy. I have no idea. Apparently, it'll kill you. So she reams me. She says, I'm going to kick you out of honors biology. I'm like, that'd actually be great. And you're never going to take honors chemistry. I'm like, that'd be better, right? But she rips me in the hallway, and I think it's all fine and good. I'm like, okay, it's been a bad day, but I'll go home. So I come in through the doors that day, and my mom's standing there in the kitchen. Michael, how'd your day go? Fine. She's like, I got a call from poison control. You want to tell me what happened in biology today? Oh, man, I wish I just wouldn't have gotten out of bed that day, literally from bad to worse. Now, there's stories like that in our lives that are funny, but what happens when it's real life? And it's not funny games, and it's not honors biology in ninth grade, but God is doing something different than you expected, and it's not what you wanted. And I shared a couple weeks ago when I got to teach Exodus 1 that I've been on staff since 2004, but I didn't share my journey as to how I got here. When I was in college, I felt, as this pre-med guy, after all that I know, I ended up pre-med, in college, and felt God's call on my life. Luckily, he took me out of pre-med, and he said, you're going to go be a pastor. And I said, I don't even know what that is, but okay. So I started down the road of going to seminary. I went to Dallas Theological Seminary in Dallas, and went to work at a church in 2001 called Watermark Community Church, an amazing church in Dallas. Loved my experience there. And about a year into it, they came to myself and another guy, and they said, Mike, we're going to reorg. Your jobs are going away. So you and your other buddy, pick. Like, what do you want to do in the organization? My other buddy was like, man, this would be fun. So he went off and did marriage ministry and is still doing it even today and loved it. And I just said, man, I don't see anything. I don't really know here on staff what I would love to do more than I was already doing. That's why I came. I'm not real sure. And they said, well, why don't you take 6 months and go figure it out? And if that's here, great. Man, if God calls you elsewhere, then great. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to call my buddy Brad Bell and see if he wants to hire me. So I called him in 2001. The well had just started about a year ago. And I said, hey, Brad, man, are you interested? And he said, absolutely. He said, why don't we fly you and Michelle out and let's interview you. Let's talk. Let's have some conversations and let's see where this may go. So my wife and I was 7 months pregnant. Like, she was literally a week away from the doctor saying, you ain't getting on an airplane. We fly out here to Fresno. We get picked up in Oakland and talk with some of the elders. And we're here and we're having a great time. And we're learning about the church. And man, my heart is rent. I've known Brad now for a decade. I'm like, Lord, this would be awesome. Brad says, man, this would be awesome. The elders thought, man, this would be awesome. And we're driving in the car with Harold Pinner, our realtor at the time. And Brad's in the front with Harold, and my wife and I are in the back, and they're showing us houses, and my wife's in the back bawling in tears. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, babe, you're embarrassing. Like, what's going on right now? And the only person that didn't want this to happen was Michelle. And we literally sat down at the table, and I'm looking at my wife like, babe, you knew why we came out here. This is a job interview. Like, this is what happens at the end of this, right? We uproot and we move here. And Brad's like, Mike, I can't in good conscience offer you a job. I can't, knowing that your wife doesn't want to be here. She wants to be close to family and all that. And I was furious. And I tried and my godliest best faking it, go, okay, you know, this is good, and babe, God has something else for us. And I was trying to be, but man, underneath, I am furious at my wife. And I went back home, and I sat at the table with a mentor of mine at that time, and I remember telling him, I feel like we've stuck a compass in Dallas and drawn a 4-hour radius around it and said, God, that is your will for us. And if it fits inside that circle, we'll do it. And if not, forget it. And that's how I felt in that time. So God, in the midst of that, said, okay, Mike, maybe you need to learn a little bit. Maybe you need to learn about how I work. And he opened up this job opportunity 45 minutes away from where I grew up, my dad's hometown, the small church in this really cool country town in Texas. Everything lined up. I was going to work with a buddy of mine that was in the same seminary, same church that we grew up in. It was a perfect fit. So we take the job, sell our house. I'm going to be a co-pastor, whatever that means. And we move out to Sherman, Texas, right? 35,000 people. And we start getting into it and we start doing ministry. And about 3 weeks into it, I realize, this is not what you guys advertised. This was not at all what I expected. My senior pastor and I were doing this. These 30-minute meetings that we were supposed to have would turn into these 3-hour blow-ups. We weren't on the same page. The elders weren't on the same page. I'm frustrated. I don't want to go to work because it's such a headache dealing with him. I'm dealing with my own immaturity and all this stuff. In the meantime, my wife's at home with a newborn and a 20-month-old, and I'm getting calls at 2 o'clock in the afternoon saying, hey, when are you coming home? I'm like, I hope never. Like, I don't want to come home. Like, you're needy. The church is whipping me. I don't want to go to work. I don't want to come home. Like, where can I hide from this? Like, is there a softball field somewhere, right, that I can go play co-ed softball or something? But I am furious in the midst of this and just wrestling with all this issue. And then about not even a year into it, I get a call from our senior pastor. He says, Mike, you need to come over. I'm like, we've already had a staff meeting this week. Why don't you just come over, okay? So I walk into his office, and he hands me an ultimatum. He says, Mike, moving forward, this is how we're going to operate. And I'm like, Robert, I can't do that. And he hands me the proverbial box. He says, pack your stuff, you're done. I've had two jobs in ministry. Both ended in failures. I'm thinking, Lord, are you kidding me? I'm trying to walk with you. I got a seminary degree. Man, I punted pre-med. I did what you asked me to do, and here I am, and this is what I get. So I start calling guys. I start looking at contacts. Are there any churches that are hiring? Man, it is nothing. Zilch. I can't get a call back. We burned through 3 months of savings, all the savings that we had as these young 20-somethings at the time, and we're literally living on a credit card at this point, hoping that something will come. And I remember calling Brad and saying, Brad, I think we may be able to get there. I think my wife's had a pretty significant experience. I think I may be able to talk her into this if there's a paycheck attached to it. And Brad says, Mike, I hired a guy for that position 2 weeks ago. He said, there's no job available here. So I think, Lord, man, I got to pay the bills. I went to Target, and I stood in the employment line at Target, and I interviewed with the manager, and he wouldn't even give me a call back. I'm like, Lord, what are you doing? And I literally thought in that moment, I may be done from vocational ministry. God, what are you doing? And in that moment, I felt this sense of, Lord, this is not how I had my life mapped out. This is not at all how I expected you to act. And that, I think, in this moment is where Moses finds himself. When things have literally gone from bad to worse, and you can't even imagine worse, but here we are in that moment. Now remember, God has a grander plan in Moses' life. He's trying to teach him humility and obedience, independence. Now, if you were to grade Moses and say, at this point in the journey, is he humble? We would say, yeah, overly humble, insecure, but he's humble. He's a different Moses than we saw 40 years ago. Is he obedient? Yeah, he said exactly what God told him to say. Is he dependent? Is he? Can you learn dependence anywhere else but the labs of life? And this is what I think God is doing in Moses' life. Now remember, Pharaoh's got a strategy here, and it's actually going to get worse before it gets better. Pharaoh's going to increase their workload, which he's done. He said, man, I'm up in the ante. You're going to work harder. I'm going to make your lives miserable. We saw that in verse 7 and 8. Not only that, but Pharaoh ultimately is going to turn the people, the Hebrews, against Moses. But the thing that I think he's most wanting to do is actually lingering there in verse 9. He says, let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work that they may pay no attention to these false words. What are the false words that Pharaoh is referring to? He's trying to kill the hope that is in the people. These words of your God who's going to deliver you, it's a farce. It's never going to happen. And if he can crush their hopes and get them back to work, then he can just quell this issue right now forever. And this is what he's ultimately about. In verses 10 through 14, now word's going to get back now to the people, to the Hebrews. Look at this with me. The taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people saying, thus says Pharaoh, I am not going to give you any straw. You're going to get it for yourselves wherever you can find it, but none of your labor will be reduced. So the people scattered throughout the land of Egypt, searching now for stubble, for straw. The taskmasters pressed them in verse 13, saying, complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw. Moreover, the foremen, these are the Hebrews of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not completed your required amount either yesterday or today in the making of the bricks as previously? They're like, what's going on? These people show up to work one day, and all of a sudden, Pharaoh's like, look, I ain't giving you squat. Get your own straw. They're like, what just changed? And all of a sudden, the foremen, who are made by the taskmasters to exercise their authority over their own brethren, they're getting now beaten at the hands of the taskmasters for not completing now their quotas. And in verse 15 and 16, the foremen now, the sons of Israel, came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, why do you deal with this way with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, yet they keep saying, make bricks, and behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people. Do you see that word repeated over and over? Pharaoh, we're your servants. We're your servants. Why are you doing this? What is happening? What is going on? We don't understand what changed. All of a sudden we wake up and this is now the current reality that we're living in. And in verse 17, it's like the light bulb goes on for them. It says now, Pharaoh said, "You are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord." Now, did the people ever make that request to Pharaoh? No, Moses did. This is Moses' fault. You went with your brother Aaron, and you stood before Pharaoh, and you made this request, and it went south. And now we are being punished. We are the ones being beaten. Our quotas are staying the same, and we're having to work harder and harder in this season, and it's awful. And they now come, the people do, in verse 20 and 21 to Moses and Aaron, and look what they say. When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron, and they were waiting for them. Notice that Moses and Aaron aren't the ones being beaten. They're not the ones being yelled at. They're kind of the white collar out of the way. They're not having to suffer the affliction. And they say now in verse 21, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us." They say to Moses, "May God judge you." Literally, the word means, "May God look at what you have done and punish you, because this is your fault. May he render justice to you, Moses, and to Aaron because of what you have done. And you have made us," it's a great word, "odious in their sight." If you're reading an ESV, it says, "You made us stink in the sight of Pharaoh," obnoxious or even abhorrent. It's the word ba'os in the Hebrew. It's the word to stink or to abhor. It is a very powerful word. Excuse me. It's the same word that when ultimately God brings about the plagues, it makes all the fish in the Nile die, and all those wretched fish are sitting on the banks of the Nile. It says that they stink and they're foul. Same word. After the plagues, when all the frogs come into the palaces and all the frogs are decaying underneath the hot Egyptian sun, it says that the land stinks and became foul. It says, "This is how you have made us in the presence of Pharaoh. We are odious. We're stinky. And literally, you have put a sword in his hand to kill us." Remember, if you guys have done this, but boy, I remember growing up with our kids when they were young and handing them like a sippy cup of milk, you know, in the back seat as we're driving around in the Fresno summers, and they're pounding their milk, and then they drop it, and then it ends up underneath the seat for a day or a week or a month, and all of a sudden you're like, "Oh, what's that? Oh, it's a science experiment, right?" And then you bring it inside the kitchen sink and you think you're gonna salvage it, and you crack open that lid that hasn't seen the light of day and it's been sitting in a 140-degree car for a month. You're like, "Oh, dear Lord," like, trash can, right? I don't even open them anymore. They go in the trash and I'll pay the $5. This is how they describe their presence before Pharaoh. He is literally, Moses has made them stink. "You have given them a reason to kill us. You've literally, Moses, put a sword in Pharaoh's hand and he wants us dead." And the result is that Moses has actually made things, if it could happen, worse than it was at the beginning of the day. The very people he is hoping to save are now the people that are cursing him. "How dare you, Moses? How could you do this to us?" And this initial hope that we saw budding at the very beginning of chapter 5 is gone, and the people's hopes are crushed. Now remember, this was Pharaoh's strategy. Increase their workload, turn the people against Moses, and crush their hope. The God of the land, Pharaoh, mission accomplished. Now in verses 22 and 23, the last two verses of the text, this is where I want to slow down. I want to linger here if we can, because this is the magic of the text. I want you to read it with me and just look at what unfolds here. It says, "Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done harm to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. You've done nothing.'" Can you imagine that, the scene? Aaron's not mentioned here. Moses is now away. He's alone with God. And he is literally just unzipping, and he is vomiting, if you will, emotionally, where he is at with the Lord. The text doesn't say it, but I gotta think there are tears. He is frustrated. He's mad. He doesn't understand what God's doing. God has not done what God said God was going to do, and he is letting God literally have a piece of his mind. He asks two questions that you and I, in our own despair moments, have asked. You see them there in verse 22. Why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you send me? Why, God? What's going on? Why are you doing this? And he's not getting an answer from God. Literally, that word harm is translated in the ESV, evil. God, why have you allowed evil to happen? You have let this unfold this way, and you could have done something about it. You have not done what I asked you to do, what you said that you would do, what I expected you to do. You have not kept up your end of the bargain. God, I responded in obedience. I did what you asked me to do. Even though that I didn't want to do it, I went and I told Pharaoh, and I told you, God, this is how it would end. And sure enough, Moses is right. And this chapter ends in utter despair. Now, Moses really has a twofold disappointment. The first, obviously, is he's frustrated at the rejection from Pharaoh, at this situation now that's unfolded the way it has. But I think the deeper issue within Moses is he's deeply disappointed with the Lord. He is angry about how God is handling his life. In John chapter 11, there's a very similar story of a gal by the name of Mary. Mary, who's mentioned as a disciple of Christ, Mary and Martha Mary, if you've heard of her. We see Mary three times in Scripture, and every time we see and are introduced to her, she is sitting at the feet of Jesus. The first time we see her, it's Mary and Martha in the house, and Mary literally is sitting, learning at the feet of Jesus while Martha's in the kitchen cooking, and Jesus says, no, she's in the right place. She's learning from me. The last time we see Mary, she's literally, again, sitting at the feet of Jesus days before he's going to be taken to the cross and crucified, and she's taking an alabaster jar of super expensive perfume and anointing Jesus' feet as if to say, I love you, and I hate what's going to happen, but I love you, and she's pouring her heart out to him. The picture that's sandwiched in the middle of those is a picture that we don't talk about often because it's not a very pretty picture of Mary. She is literally in mourning because her brother Lazarus is on his deathbed and she is freaking out. She knows Jesus. She knows what's going on. Jesus has gotten word that Lazarus is literally on his deathbed. He's in a town away on the other side of the Jordan River. And Mary knows if Jesus comes, something can change. At this point, our only hope is in this guy. And it says that Jesus stays in this town 4 days longer than he planned. And in the meantime, Lazarus dies. And then Jesus comes strolling back into town with his disciples, and he meets Mary on this road. In her despair, she's just seen her brother perish. And the only recorded words in the entire Bible that we have of Mary, she utters one sentence to Jesus. I want you to listen to this. This is what she says in this moment. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. If you had operated the way that I expect you to operate, had you showed up, I know you can fix this situation, but you're not doing what I expect you to do in this moment. She offers Jesus even a subtle rebuke in that moment. Her pain and her anger are boiling to the surface, and she's asking the same question that you and I ask all the time. How could a good God allow a situation like this to unfold? How could a powerful, sovereign God not intervene? If he's truly in control, then bad things like this shouldn't happen to good people. This is not making any sense. And the text just says that Jesus in that moment weeps with her. He cries and he mourns with her. But in that moment, nothing changes. We're reading through the life of David right now in our biblical studies and our residency program. And we're in this season as we're reading about him where God is absolutely filleting David open. He is ripping crutches from David's life, and you're watching him just get stripped, and it's awful. God's removing all the things that David is leaning on other than the Lord, ultimately so that David will lean on the Lord in times of trouble and pain. And we have the beauty of being able to see the end game. We know that in a few chapters we're going to read that David's going to get the throne and things are going to change and this season's going to end. But David in this time, he can't see that. Mary in this moment does not know that in just literally minutes from now, Jesus is going to get up and he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. She doesn't know that yet. Moses doesn't know that chapter 6 is coming and that God's going to show up and he says, Moses, I am going to redeem these people. I am going to deliver them from slavery. I promise to do that, but I'm not going to do it right now. I'm going to do things on my timetable, thank you very much, not yours. And friends, I think if we're honest, every one of us at some point in life end up here, where we are deeply disappointed at God. And if we're honest, we're angry at God, like I was in that moment where I'm watching my wife bawl her eyes out in her car saying, how dare you do this to me right now? God, how can you allow this to go this way? You owe me different than this, God. This is not okay. And we are revealing what's under the surface. What do we do when we have come to the end of our rope and that we think God has failed us? In reality, it's not God that's failed us. It's our theology of God that has failed us. Let me explain. There's a very significant difference between the theology of lecture and the theology or the reality, if you will, of lab. What do you do when the God that you think you know behaves in a way that's inconsistent with your present reality? What do you do in those moments when God is just crushing you and you expected him and wanted him and wished him to be different and he's just not? Can I maybe leave us with just a couple insights that I see from Moses, that I see in Mary, that we see in David's life as well, that I think are crucial for all of us in these moments? Number one, when you are here and you are at that point where you're just, you can't put it all together, number one, embrace your theology. What I love about Moses and what I love about Mary both, do you see how they begin this interaction with God? You see what Moses says in verse 22? He returned to the Lord and he said, oh Lord, Adonai, Master. He identifies God for who he is. God, you're in control. I am not. Mary says the same thing. She identifies Jesus in that story as Lord, as Master, the Greek word that means the exact same thing as this word here in Hebrew. They come to God in their pain. Now notice what they don't do. They don't numb their pain somewhere else. They don't run to escapes that could temporarily medicate them or make them feel better about their situation. They're not hitting the bottle or whatever other escapes they could go to in that day. They go to the Lord, and I think that's right. There was a lady in Denton when I was in college that was wrestling with terminal cancer, and she wasn't much older than I am right now. She's processing through this, and some of the ladies that were sitting at her feet and learning from her, they said, Margaret, how do you handle this season of your life? And she said something so poignant. She said, you lean on your theology. Like, what does that mean? In your deepest moments of pain, you lean on your theology. She said, in those moments where you're in pain and you have nothing, you have to know who God is. You have to know that he's good because it doesn't feel good. You have to know that he's sovereign because he doesn't feel sovereign right now. You have to know that he's in control of my cancer, even though it doesn't feel that way. She said, you have to lean and know who God is in those moments. And you can see what happened to Moses, and you can see what happened to Mary. Their theology was built on something that wouldn't sustain them. Their theology in those moments caved in. God indeed will deliver Israel, but not yet. And Moses knew better. God tells him in Exodus chapter 4, I know the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in their midst, and after that, he will let you go. God told this to Moses. Moses, this isn't the end of the game. This is the beginning. This is step one, but that's not what Moses wanted. That's not what he expected. He wanted God to act now. Mary wanted God to act now to heal and recover her brother's fullness of health in that moment, not to allow him to die. And that was my expectation of God in Texas. Lord, show up, fix this, medicate my situation, and do what I want you to do. But I think in those moments, we've got to lean on our theology. Secondly, I would say this. Allow lab to deepen your intimacy with God. Our response, by the way, in these moments is very telling of how we really view God. In that moment in Sherman for me, when I was begging God to change my situation, when Moses is begging God to get him out of this situation with Pharaoh, when Mary's begging God to heal her brother, what are they expecting at this moment? They're expecting some Superman God to pull off his Clark Kent robe, to jump in the situation and fix it because we prayed. They want the genie in the bottle God that shows up on their demands when they say to come, how they say to come, and how they want it done. Who's in control in that situation? Who's God in that picture? It certainly isn't God. God does not work like that. And it's only in these moments of lab that God can truly teach us what it means to depend on him. You don't learn that in a book. You don't learn that in a sermon. You don't learn that in theology class. You learn dependence in one place and one place only. You learn it in life. And you learn it when it gets hard and it gets difficult. And what you believe about God really comes to the surface. Is it true? Is he really sovereign? Mike, is he sovereign when you have no money, your kids need to eat, you're frustrated, and the guy from Target won't even call you back? Is it really true then? Can God come in and still be God in your life? Moses, even though this isn't your plan, can I still be God? Can I still work the way I want to work? And will you trust me even though everything around you is falling apart? Will you lean into me in those moments? And I think it's telling, if we're not careful, what kind of God we truly worship if we don't embrace the God of the lab and allow him to teach us and allow him to show us that. Carolyn James, in her book, When Life and Beliefs Collide, wrote about this subject, specifically speaking of Mary's. I was talking to my wife about this sermon. She's like, oh, I got a book for you. I'm like, okay. Well, since I threw you into the bus like 9 times, I probably ought to read your book. So here goes. This gal makes a quote, and I thought, man, this is brilliant. Speaking of this moment in Mary's life, and I think it applies to us and it applies to Moses, she says this: God brings us here to feel such pain and through it to know the depths of our need for him. He uses our struggles to help us realize we don't actually know him nearly as well as we think we do, and to draw us closer to him. Difficult as it is to be here, this is where we do our best learning. Not theoretical, but the deeply personal learning to trust our God when he doesn't fit our expectations. Isn't that good? Friends, you've been there. Some of you are here right now. I've talked to a ton of folks at our church, and I know that there is pain happening in our body. There's great stuff as well, right? And if you're not here now, I can promise you, you're going to be one day. And you're going to get to walk your theology out in lab. And God is going to call you in those moments as he continually does with me to trust him. Now, I wish I could tell you the Mike of 15, 17 years ago that doesn't trust God in hard situations has somehow magically changed. Man, I wrestle with this. When things go south, I want to point fingers at God. I want to point fingers at people. I want my life to be different. And I have a hard time leaning in when I can't see the end game, when I can't figure out, God, what chapter in my life is this going to end? And when does it get better? I would really like to read that now. I don't want to wait till then. But I wrestle with that, as do you. Now, the good news in the midst of all of this is we have the privilege of believers of looking back at this story with 3,500 years of history between us. And the beautiful thing that happened in that 3,500 years that we're all aware of is the cross. God, friends, has redeemed us. We have hope in the gospel. We have a God that experienced great pain and suffering on our behalf. And we have a high priest who says, I identify with that. I know what you're going through. I've wrenched my soul for you, and I can feel and know the pain that you've been through. And in those moments, because of the gospel, friends, we can lean on him. Can I encourage you, if you're there and you're in a Moses moment in verses 22 and 23, and you're asking God why, and he's not giving you the answers, and friends, more than likely he's not, trust God in that process. Lean in on him and allow that time of lab to shape your lecture theology. Let's pray. Father, thank you that we get real pictures of real people like this, that Moses feels the freedom to just unload on you, that he feels knit enough to who you are to tell you his pain, to tell you his grief, and that you are God, ultimately God in chapter 6, that's going to answer those things. You're going to bring about deliverance. You are going to redeem your people as you said you would. But your plan has a few more bumps, a few more curves in it, Father, that sometimes we're comfortable with. Would you help us, Father, in those moments to trust you, to lean into you, to walk with you? And even when everything else around us has fallen apart, Father, would you be our constant? Would you be our anchor in the midst of our storms, God? Help us to walk with you, we pray, in these moments. In Christ's name.